This is Audible.
Tim Ferriss presents Ego is the Enemy, written by Ryan Holiday, narrated by Ryan Holiday. Do not believe that he who seeks to comfort you lives untroubled among the simple and quiet words that sometimes do you good. His life has much difficulty and sadness and remains far behind yours. Were it otherwise, he never would have been able to find those words. The words of Rainer Maria Rilke. The Painful Prologue. This is not a book about me. But since this is a book about ego, I'm going to address a question that I'd be a hypocrite not to have thought about. Who the hell am I to write it? My story is not particularly important for the lessons that follow, but I want to tell it briefly here at the beginning in order to provide some context. For I have experienced ego at each of its stages in my short life. Aspiration, success, failure, and back again, and back again. When I was 19 years old, sensing some astounding and life-changing opportunities, I dropped out of college. Mentors vied for my attention, groomed me as their protege. Seen as going places, I was the kid. Success came quickly. After I became the youngest executive at a Beverly Hills talent management agency, I helped sign and work with a number of huge rock bands. I advised on books that went on to sell millions of copies and invent their own literary genres. Around the time I turned 21, I came on as a strategist for American Apparel, then one of the hottest fashion brands in the world. Soon I was the director of marketing. By 25, I'd published my first book, which was an immediate and controversial bestseller, with my face prominently on the cover. A studio optioned the rights to create a television show about my life. In the next few years, I accumulated many of the trappings of success, influence, a platform, press, resources, money, even a little notoriety. Later, I built a successful company on the back of those assets, where I worked with well-known, well-paying clients and did the kind of work that got me invited to speak at conferences and fancy events. With success comes the temptation to tell oneself a story, to round off the edges, to cut out your lucky breaks and add a certain mythology to it all. You know, that arcing narrative of Herculean struggle for greatness against all odds. Sleeping on the floor, being disowned by my parents, suffering for my ambition. It's the type of storytelling in which eventually your talent becomes your identity and your accomplishments become your worth. But a story like this is never honest or helpful. In my retelling to you just now, I left a lot out. Conveniently omitted were the stresses and temptations, the stomach-turning drops and the mistakes. All the mistakes were left on the cutting room floor in favor of the highlight reel. They are the times I would rather not discuss. A public evisceration by someone I looked up to, which so crushed me at the time that I was later taken to the emergency room. The day I lost my nerve, walked into my boss's office and told him I couldn't cut it and was going back to school, and meant it. The ephemeral nature of bestsellerdom and how short it actually was, a week. The book signing that one person showed up at. The company I founded tearing itself to pieces and having to rebuild it, twice. These are just some of the moments that get nicely edited out. This fuller picture itself is still only a fraction of a life, but at least it hits more of the important notes, at least the important ones for this book, ambition, achievement, and adversity. I'm not someone who believes in epiphanies. There is no one moment that changes a person. There are many. During a period of about 6 months in 2014, it seemed those moments were all happening in succession. First, American Apparel, where I did much of my best work, teetered on the edge of bankruptcy, hundreds of millions of dollars in debt, a shell of its former self. Its founder, who I deeply admired since I was a young man, was unceremoniously fired by his own hand-picked board of directors, and down to sleeping on a friend's couch. Then the talent agency, where I made my bones, was in similar shape, sued peremptorily by clients to whom it owed a lot of money. Another mentor of mine seemingly unraveled around the same time, taking our relationship with him. These were the people I had shaped my life around, the people I looked up to and trained under. Their stability, financially, emotionally, psychologically, was not just something I took for granted, it was central to my existence and self-worth. And yet there they were, imploding right in front of me, one right after another. The wheels were coming off, or so it felt. To go from wanting to be like someone your whole life to realizing you never want to be like him is a kind of whiplash that you can't prepare for. Nor was I exempt from this dissolution myself. Just when I could least afford it, problems I had neglected in my own life began to emerge. Despite my successes, I found myself back in the city I had started in, stressed and overworked, having handed much of my hard-earned freedom away because I couldn't say no to money and the thrill of a good crisis. I was wound so tight that the slightest disruption sent me into a sputtering, inconsolable rage. My work, which had always come easy, became labored. My faith in myself and other people collapsed. My quality of life did too. I remember arriving at my house one day, after weeks on the road, and having an intense panic attack because the Wi-Fi wasn't working. If I don't send these emails, if I don't send these emails, if I don't send these emails, if I don't send these emails. You think you're doing what you're supposed to. Society rewards you for it. And then you watch your future wife walk out the door because you aren't the person you used to be. How does something like this happen? Can you really go from feeling like you're standing on the shoulders of giants one day, and the next you're prying yourself out of the rubble of multiple implosions, trying to pick up the pieces from the ruins? One benefit, however, was that it forced me to come to terms with the fact that I was a workaholic. Not in a, oh, he just works too much kind of way, or in the just relax and play it off sense, but more, if he doesn't start going to meetings and get clean, he will die an early death. I realized that the same drive and compulsion that had made me successful so early came with a price, as it had for so many others. It wasn't so much the amount of work, but the outsized role it had taken in my sense of self. I was trapped so terribly inside my own head that I was a prisoner to my own thoughts. The result was a sort of treadmill of pain and frustration, and I needed to figure out why, unless I wanted to break in an equally tragic fashion. For a long time, as a researcher and writer, I have studied history and business. Like anything that evolves people, seen over a long enough timeline, universal issues begin to emerge. These are the topics I had long been fascinated with. Foremost among them was ego. I was not unfamiliar with ego and its effects. In fact, I had been researching this book for nearly a year before the events I have just recounted for you. But my painful experiences in this period brought the notions I was studying into focus in ways that I could never have previously understood. It allowed me to see the ill effects of ego played out not just in myself or across the pages of history, but in friends and clients and colleagues, some at the highest levels of many industries. Ego has cost the people I admire hundreds of millions of dollars, and like Sisyphus, rolled them back from their goals just as they've achieved them. I have now at least peeked over that precipice myself. A few months after my own realization, I had the phrase, "Ego is the enemy," tattooed on my right forearm. Where the words came from, I don't know, probably from a book I read long, long ago, but they were immediately a source of great solace and direction. On my left arm, of similarly muddled attribution, it says, "The obstacle is the way." It's these two phases that I look at now every single day and use them to guide the decisions in my life. I can't help but see them when I swim, when I meditate, when I write, when I get out of the shower in the morning, and both prepare me, admonish me, to choose the right course in essentially any situation I might face. I wrote this book not because I have attained some wisdom that I feel qualified to preach, but because it's the book I wish existed at critical turning points in my own life, when I, like everyone else, was called to answer the most critical questions a person can ask themselves. Who do I want to be, and what path will I take? In Latin, quovad vecte sectabor etor. And because I've found these questions to be timeless and universal, except for this note, I've tried to rely on philosophy and historical examples in this book instead of my personal life. While the history books are filled with tales of obsessive, visionary geniuses who remade the world in their image with sheer, almost irrational force, I found that if you go looking, you'll find that history is also made by individuals who fought their egos at every turn, who eschewed the spotlight and put their higher goals above their desires for recognition. Engaging with and retelling these stories has been my method of learning and absorbing them. Like my other books, this one is deeply influenced by Stoic philosophy and indeed all the great classical thinkers. I borrow heavily from them all in my writing, just as I have leaned on them my entire life. If there's anything here that helps you in this book, it is because of them and not me. The orator Demosthenes once said that virtue begins with understanding and is fulfilled by courage. We must begin by seeing ourselves and the world in a new way for the first time. Then we must fight to be different and fight to stay different. That's the hard part. I'm not saying that you should repress or crush every ounce of ego in your life, or that doing so is even possible. These are just reminders, moral stories to encourage our better impulses. In Aristotle's famous Ethics, he uses the analogy of a warped piece of wood to describe human nature. In order to eliminate warping or curvature, a skilled woodworker slowly applies pressure in the opposite direction, essentially bending it straight. Of course, a couple thousand years later, Kant snorted, "Out of the crooked timber of humanity, nothing can be made straight." Well, we might not ever be straight, but we can strive for straighter. It's always nice to be made to feel special or empowered or inspired, but that's not the aim of this book. Instead, I have tried to arrange these pages so that you might end in the same place that I did when I finished writing it. That is, you'll think less of yourself. I hope you will be less invested in the story you tell about your own specialness, and as a result, you will be liberated to accomplish the world-changing work you've set out to achieve. Introduction. The first principle is that you must not fool yourself, and you are the easiest person to fool. Richard Feynman. Maybe you're young and brimming with ambition. Maybe you're young and you're struggling. Maybe you've made that first couple million, signed your first deal, been selected to some elite group, or maybe you've already accomplished enough to last a lifetime. Maybe you're stunned to find out how empty it is at the top. Maybe you're charged with leading others through a crisis. Maybe you just got fired. Maybe you just hit rock bottom. Wherever you are, whatever you're doing, your worst enemy already lives inside you, your ego. Not me, you think. No one would ever call me an egomaniac. Perhaps you've always thought of yourself as a pretty balanced person. But for people with ambitions, talents, drives, and potential to fulfill, ego comes with the territory. Precisely what makes us so promising as thinkers, doers, creatives, and entrepreneurs, what drives us to the top of those fields, makes us vulnerable to this darker side of the psyche. Now, this is not a book about ego in the Freudian sense. Freud was fond of explaining the ego by way of analogy. Our ego was a rider on a horse with our unconscious drives representing the animal, while the ego tried to direct them. Modern psychologists, on the other hand, use the word egotist to refer to someone dangerously focused on themselves and with disregard for anyone else. All of these definitions are true enough, but of little value outside a clinical setting. The ego we see most commonly goes by a more casual definition, an unhealthy belief in our own importance. Arrogance, self-centered ambition. That's the definition this book will use. It's that petulant child inside every person, the one that chooses getting his or her way over anything or anyone else. The need to be better than, more than, recognized for, far past any reasonable utility. That's ego. It's the sense of superiority and certainty that exceeds the bounds of confidence and talent. It's when the notion of ourselves and the world grows so inflated that it begins to distort the reality that surrounds us. When, as the football coach Bill Walsh explained, self-confidence becomes arrogance, assertiveness becomes obstinacy, and self-assurance becomes reckless abandon. This is the ego, as the writer Cyril Connolly warned, that sucks us down like the law of gravity. In this way, ego is the enemy of what you want and of what you have, of mastering a craft, of real creative insight, of working well with others, of building loyalty and support, of longevity, of repeating and retaining your success. It repulses advantages and opportunities. It is a magnet for enemies and errors. It is Sila and Charybdis. Most of us aren't egomaniacs, but ego is there at the root of almost every conceivable problem and obstacle, from why we can't win to why we need to win all the time and at the expense of others, from why we don't seem to have what we want to why having what we want doesn't seem to make us feel any better. We don't usually see it this way. We think that something else is to blame for our problems, most often other people. We are, as the poet Lucretius put it a few thousand years ago, the proverbial sick man ignorant of the cause of his malady. Especially for successful people who can't see what ego prevents them from doing, because all they can see is what they've already done. With every ambition and goal we have, big or small, ego is there undermining us on the very journey we've put everything into pursuing. The pioneering CEO Harold Jeanin compared egoism to alcoholism. He said, "The egotist does not stumble about knocking things off his desk. He does not stammer or drool. No, instead he becomes more and more arrogant, and some people, not knowing what is underneath such an attitude, mistake his arrogance for a sense of power and self-confidence." You could say that they start to mistake that about themselves, too, not realizing the disease they've contracted, or that they're killing themselves with it. If ego is the voice that tells us we're better than we really are, we can say ego inhibits true success by preventing a direct and honest connection to the world around us. One of the early members of Alcoholics Anonymous defined ego as a conscious separation from what? Everything. The ways this separation manifests itself negatively are immense. We can't work with other people if we've put up walls. We can't improve the world if we don't understand it or ourselves. We can't take or receive feedback if we are incapable of or uninterested in hearing from outside sources. We can't recognize opportunities or create them if instead of seeing what is in front of us, we live inside our own fantasy. Without an accurate accounting of our own abilities compared to others, what we have is not confidence, but delusion. How are we supposed to reach, motivate, or lead other people if we can't relate to their needs, because we've lost touch with our own? The performance artist Marina Abramovic puts it directly. If you start believing in your own greatness, it is the death of your creativity. Just one thing keeps ego around: comfort. Pursuing great work, whether it is in sports or art or business, is often terrifying. Ego soothes that fear. It's a salve to that insecurity. Replacing the rational and aware parts of our psyche with bluster and self-absorption, ego tells us what we want to hear when we want to hear it. But it is a short-term fix with a long-term consequence. Ego was always there. Now it's emboldened. Now more than ever, our culture fans the flames of ego. It's never been easier to talk, to puff ourselves up. We can brag about our goals to millions of our fans or followers, things only rock stars or cult leaders used to have. We can follow and interact with our idols on Twitter. We can read books and sites and watch TED Talks, drink from a fire hose of inspiration and validation like never before. There's an app for that. We can name ourselves CEO of our exists-only-on-paper company. We can announce big news on social media and let the congratulations roll in. We can publish articles about ourselves in outlets that used to be sources of objective journalism. Some of us do this more than others, but it's only a matter of degree. Besides the changes in technology, we're told to believe in our own uniqueness above all else. We're told to think big, live big, to be memorable, and dare greatly. We think that success requires a bold vision or some sweeping plan. After all, that's what the founders of this company or that championship team supposedly had. But did they? Did they really? We see risk-taking swagger and successful people in the media, and eager for our own success, try to reverse engineer the right attitude, the right pose. We intuit a causal relationship that isn't there. We assume the symptoms of success are the same as success itself, and in our naivete confuse the byproduct with the cause. Sure, ego has worked for some. Many of history's most famous men and women were notoriously egotistical, but so were many of its greatest failures. Far more of them, in fact. But here we are with a culture that urges us to roll the dice, to make the gamble, ignoring the stakes. Wherever you go, ego is too. At any given time in life, people find themselves in one of three stages. We are aspiring to something, trying to make a dent in the universe. We have achieved success, perhaps a little, perhaps a lot, or we have failed, recently or continually. Most of us are in these stages in a fluid sense. We're aspiring until we succeed until we fail, or until we aspire to more, and after we fail, we can begin to aspire or succeed again. Ego is the enemy every step along this way. In a sense, ego is the enemy of building, of maintaining, and of recovering. When things come fast and easy, this might be fine, but in times of change, of difficulty. And therefore, the three parts that this book is organized into, aspire, success, failure. The aim of that structure is simple, to help you suppress ego early before bad habits take hold, to replace the temptations of ego with humility and discipline when we experience success, and to cultivate strength and fortitude so that when fate turns against you, you're not wrecked by failure. In short, it will help us to be humble in our aspirations, gracious in our success, resilient in our failures. That is not to say you are not unique and that you don't have something amazing to contribute in your short time on this planet. This is not to say that there is not room to push past creative boundaries, to invent, to feel inspired, or to aim for truly ambitious change or innovation. On the contrary, in order to properly do these things and take these risks, we need balance. As the Quaker William Penn observed, buildings that lie so exposed to the weather need a good foundation. So what now? This audiobook that you're listening to is based around one optimistic assumption, that your ego is not some power you're forced to satiate at every turn. It can be managed. It can be directed. In this book, we will look at individuals like William Tecumseh Sherman, Katharine Graham, Jackie Robinson, Eleanor Roosevelt, Bill Walsh, Benjamin Franklin, Belisarius, Angela Merkel, and George C. Marshall. Could they have accomplished what they accomplished, saving faltering companies, advancing the art of war, integrating baseball, revolutionizing football offense, standing up to tyranny, bravely bearing misfortune, if ego had left them ungrounded or self-absorbed? It was their sense of reality and awareness, one that the author and strategist Robert Greene once said that we must take to like a spider in its web, that was at the core of their great art, great writing, great design, great business, great marketing, and great leadership. What we find when we study these individuals is that they were grounded, circumspect, and unflinchingly real. Not that any of them were wholly without ego, but they knew how to suppress it, channel it, subsume it when it counted. They were great, yet humble. Wait, but so-and-so had a huge ego and was successful. But what about Steve Jobs? What about Kanye West? We can seek to rationalize the worst behavior by pointing to outliers, but no one is truly successful because they are delusional, self-absorbed, or disconnected. Even if these traits are correlated or associated with certain well-known individuals, so are a few others. Addiction, abuse of themselves and others, depression, mania. In fact, what we see when we study these people is that they did their best work in the moments when they fought back against these impulses, disorders, and flaws. Only when free of ego and baggage can anyone perform to their utmost. For this reason, we're also going to look at individuals like Howard Hughes, the Persian king Xerxes, John DeLorean, Alexander the Great, and at the many cautionary tales of others who lost their grip on reality and in the process made it clear what a gamble ego can be. We'll look at the costly lessons they learned and at the price they paid in misery and self-destruction. We'll look at how often even the most successful people can vacillate between humility and ego and the problems this causes. When we remove ego, we're left with what is real. What replaces ego is humility, yes, but rock-hard humility and confidence. Whereas ego is artificial, this type of confidence can hold weight. Ego is stolen. Confidence is earned. Ego is self-anointed. Its swagger is artifice. One is girding yourself and the other gaslighting. It's the difference between potent and poisonous. As you'll hear in the pages that follow, that self-confidence took an unassuming and underestimated general and turned him into America's foremost warrior and strategist during the Civil War. Ego took a different general from the heights of power and influence after that same war and drove him to destitution and ignominy. One took a quiet, sober German scientist and made her not just a new kind of leader, but a force for peace. The other took two different but equally brilliant and bold engineering minds of the 20th century and built them up in a whirlwind of hype and celebrity before dashing their hopes against the rocks of failure, bankruptcy, scandal, and insanity. One guided one of the worst teams in NFL history to the Super Bowl in 3 seasons and then on to be one of the most dominant dynasties in the game. Meanwhile, countless other coaches, politicians, entrepreneurs, and writers have overcome similar odds, only to succumb to the more inevitable probability of handing the top spot right back to someone else. Some learn humility, some choose ego. Some are prepared for the vicissitudes of fate, both positive and negative. Others are not. Which will you choose? Who will you be? You're listening to this book because you sense that you'll need to answer this question eventually, consciously or not. Well, here we are. Let's get to it. Part 1. Aspire. Here we are setting out to do something. We have a goal, a calling, a new beginning. Every great journey begins here, yet far too many of us never reach our intended destination. Ego, more often than not, is the culprit. We build ourselves up with fantastical stories. We pretend we have it all figured out. We let our star burn bright and hot only to fizzle out, and we have no idea why. These are the symptoms of ego, for which humility and reality are the cure. To whatever you aspire, ego is your enemy. He is a bold surgeon, they say, whose hand does not tremble when he performs an operation upon his own person. And he is often equally bold who does not hesitate to pull off the mysterious veil of self-delusion which covers from his view the deformities of his own conduct. Adam Smith. Sometime around the year 374 BC, Isocrates, one of the most well-known teachers and rhetoricians in Athens, wrote a letter to a young man named Demonicus. Isocrates had been a friend of the boy's recently deceased father, and wanted to pass on to him some advice on how to follow his father's example. The advice ranged from practical to moral, all communicated in what Isocrates described as noble maxims. They were, as he put it, precepts for the years to come. Like many of us, Demonicus was ambitious, which is why Isocrates wrote to him, because the path of ambition can be dangerous. Isocrates began by informing the young man that no adornment so becomes you as modesty, justice, and self-control, for these are the virtues by which, as all men are agreed, the character of the young is held in restraint. Practice self-control, he said, warning Demonicus not to fall under the sway of temper, pleasure, and pain, and abhor flatterers as you would deceivers, for both, if trusted, injure those who trust them. He wanted him to be affable in your relations with those who approach you, and never haughty, for the pride of the arrogant even slaves can hardly endure, and be slow in deliberation, but be prompt to carry out your resolves. And the best thing which we have in ourselves is good judgment. Constantly train your intellect, he told him, for the greatest thing in the smallest compass is a sound mind in a human body. Some of his advice might sound familiar, because it made its way over the next 2,000 years to William Shakespeare, who often warned about ego run amok. In fact, in Hamlet, using this very letter as his model, Shakespeare puts Isocrates' words in the mouth of his character Polonius in a speech to his son Laertes. The speech, if you happen to have heard it, wraps up with this little verse. This above all, to thine own self be true, and it must follow, as the night the day, thou canst not then be false to any man. Farewell, my blessing season this in thee. As it happened, Shakespeare's words also made their way to a young United States military officer named William Tecumseh Sherman, who would go on to become perhaps this country's greatest general and strategic thinker. He may never have heard of Isocrates, but he loved the play and often quoted this very speech. Like Demonicus, Sherman's father died when he was very young. Like Demonicus, he was taken under the wing of a wise older man, in this case Thomas Ewing, a soon-to-be U.S. senator and friend of Sherman's father, who adopted the young boy and raised him as his own. What's interesting about Sherman is that despite his connected father, almost no one would have predicted much more than regional accomplishments, least of all that he would one day need to take the unprecedented step of refusing the presidency of the United States. Unlike a Napoleon who bursts upon the scene from nowhere and disappears in failure just as quickly, Sherman's ascent was a slow and gradual one. He spent his early years at West Point and then in the Army. For his first few years in service, Sherman traversed nearly the entire United States on horseback, slowly learning with each posting. As the rumblings of Civil War broke out, Sherman made his way east to volunteer his services, and he was shortly put to use at the Battle of Bull Run, a rather disastrous Union defeat. Benefiting from a dire shortage of leadership, Sherman was promoted to Brigadier General and was summoned to meet with President Lincoln and his top military advisor. On several occasions, Sherman freely strategized and planned with the president, but at the end of his trip, he made one strange request. He'd accept his new promotion only with the assurance that he'd not have to assume superior command. Would Lincoln give him his word on that? With every other general asking for as much rank and power as possible, Lincoln happily agreed. At this point in time, Sherman felt more comfortable as a number two. He felt he had an honest appreciation for his own abilities and that this role best suited him. Imagine that. An ambitious person turning down a chance to advance in responsibilities because he actually wanted to be ready for them. Is that really so crazy? Not that Sherman was always the perfect model of restraint and order. Early in the war, tasked with defending the state of Kentucky with insufficient troops, his mania and tendency to doubt himself combined in a wicked way. Ranting and raving about being undersupplied, unable to get out of his own head, paranoid about enemy movements, he broke form and spoke injudiciously to several newspaper reporters. In the ensuing controversy, he was temporarily recalled from his command. It took weeks of rest for him to recover. It was one of a few nearly catastrophic moments in his otherwise steadily ascendant career. It was after this brief stumble, having learned from it, that Sherman truly made his mark. For instance, during the siege at Fort Donelson, Sherman technically held a senior rank to General Ulysses S. Grant. While the rest of Lincoln's generals fought amongst themselves for personal power and recognition, Sherman waived his rank, choosing to cheerfully support and reinforce Grant instead of issuing orders. "This is your show," Sherman told him in a note accompanying a shipment of supplies. "Call on me for any assistance I can provide." Together, they won one of the Union's first victories in the war. Building on his success, Sherman began to advocate for his famous March to the Sea, a strategically bold and audacious plan, not born out of some creative genius, but rather relying on the exact topography he'd scouted and studied as a young officer in what had then seemed like a pointless backwater outpost. But where Sherman had once been cautious, he was now confident. But unlike so many others who possess great ambition, he earned this opinion. As he carved a path from Chattanooga to Atlanta and then Atlanta to the sea, he avoided traditional battle after traditional battle. Any student of military history can see how the exact same invasion, driven by ego instead of a strong sense of purpose, would have had a far different ending. His realism allowed him to see a path through the South that others thought impossible. His entire theory of maneuver warfare rested on deliberately avoiding frontal assaults or shows of strength in the form of pitched battles, and ignoring criticism designed to bait a reaction. He paid no notice and stuck to his plan. By the end of the war, Sherman was one of the most famous men in America, yet he sought no public office and had no taste for politics, and wished simply to do his job and then eventually retire. Dismissing the incessant praise and attention endemic to such success, he wrote as a warning to his friend Grant, "Be natural in yourself, and this glittering flattery will be as the passing breeze of the sea on a warm summer day." One of Sherman's biographers summarized the man and his unique accomplishments in a remarkable passage. It is why he serves as our model in this phase of our ascent. He wrote, "Among men who rise to fame and leadership, two types are recognizable, those who are born with a belief in themselves and those in whom it is a slow growth dependent on actual achievement. To the men of the last type, their own success is a constant surprise, and its fruits the more delicious, yet to be tested cautiously with a haunting sense of doubt whether it is not all a dream. In that doubt lies true modesty, not the sham of insincere self-deprecation, but the modesty of moderation in the Greek sense. It is poise, not pose." One must ask, if your belief in yourself is not dependent on actual achievement, then what is it dependent on? The answer too often, when we are just setting out, is nothing. Ego. And this is why we so often see precipitous rises followed by calamitous falls. So which type of person will you be? Like all of us, Sherman had to balance talent and ambition and intensity, especially when he was young. His victory in this struggle was largely why he was able to manage the life-altering success that eventually came his way. This probably all sounds strange. Where Isocrates and Shakespeare wished us to be self-contained, self-motivated, and ruled by principle, most of us have been trained to do the opposite. Our cultural values almost try to make us dependent on validation, entitled, and ruled by our emotions. For a generation, parents and teachers have focused on building up everyone's self-esteem. From there, the themes of our gurus and public figures have almost exclusively aimed at inspiring, encouraging, and assuring us that we can do whatever we set our minds to. In reality, this makes us weak. Yes, you with all your talent and promise as a boy wonder or girl who's going places. We take it for granted that you have promise. It's why you've landed in the prestigious university you now attend, why you secured the funding you have for your business, why you've been hired or promoted, why whatever opportunity you now have has fallen in your lap. As Irving Berlin put it, talent is only the starting point. The question is, will you be able to make the most of it? Or will you be your own worst enemy? Will you snuff out the flame that is just getting going? What we see in Sherman was a man deeply tied and connected to reality. He was a man who came from nothing and accomplished great things without ever feeling like he was in some way entitled to the honors he received. In fact, he regularly and consistently deferred to others and was more than happy to contribute to a winning team, even if it meant less credit or fame for himself. It's sad to think that generations of young boys learned about Pickett's glorious cavalry charge, a Confederate charge that failed, but the model of Sherman as a quiet, unglamorous realist is forgotten, or worse, vilified. One might say that the ability to evaluate one's own ability is the most important skill of all. Without it, improvement is impossible, and certainly ego makes it difficult every step of the way. It is certainly more pleasurable to focus on our talents and strengths, but where does that get us? Arrogance and self-absorption inhibit growth. So does fantasy and vision. In this phase, you must practice seeing yourself with a little distance, cultivating the ability to get out of your own head. Detachment is a sort of natural ego antidote. It's easy to be emotionally invested and infatuated with your own work. Any and every narcissist can do that. What is rare is not raw talent, skill, or even confidence, but humility, diligence, and self-awareness. For your work to have truth in it, it must come from truth. If you want to be more than a flash in the pan, you must be prepared to focus on the long term. We will learn that though we think big, we must act and live small in order to accomplish what we seek. Because we'll be action and education focused and forgo validation and status, our ambition will not be grandiose but iterative, one foot in front of the other, learning and growing and putting in the time. With their aggression, intensity, self-absorption, and endless self-promotion, our competitors don't realize how they jeopardize their own efforts, to say nothing of their sanity. We will challenge the myth of the self-assured genius for whom doubt and introspection is foreign, as well as challenge the myth of the pained, tortured artist who must sacrifice his health for his work. Where they are both divorced from reality and divorced from other people, we will be deeply connected, aware, learning from it all. Facts are better than dreams, as Churchill put it. Although we share with many others a vision for greatness, we understand that our path towards it is very different from theirs. Following Sherman and Isocrates, we will understand that ego is our enemy on that journey, so that when we do achieve our success, it will not sink us, but make us stronger. Talk, talk, talk. Those who know do not speak. Those who speak do not know. Lao Tzu. In his famous 1934 campaign for the governorship of California, the author and activist Upton Sinclair took an unusual step. Before the election, he published a short book titled I, Governor of California, and How I Ended Poverty, in which he outlined, in the past tense, the brilliant policies he had enacted as governor, the office he had not yet won. It was an untraditional move from an untraditional campaign, intended to leverage Sinclair's best asset. As an author, he knew he could communicate with the public in a way that others couldn't. Now, Sinclair's campaign was always a long shot, and hardly in good shape when they published the book. But observers at the time noticed immediately the effect it had, not on the voters, but on Sinclair himself. As Kerry McWilliams later wrote about his friend's gubernatorial bid as it went south, Upton not only realized that he would be defeated, but seemed somehow to have lost interest in the campaign. In that vivid imagination of his, he had already acted out the part of I, Governor of California. So why bother to enact it in real life? The book was a bestseller, the campaign a failure. Sinclair lost by something like 250,000 votes, a margin of more than 10 percentage points. He was utterly decimated in what was probably the first modern election. It's clear what happened. His talk got out ahead of his campaign, and the will to bridge the gap collapsed. Most politicians don't write books like that, but they get ahead of themselves just the same. It's a temptation that exists for everyone, for talk and hype to replace action. The empty text box. What's on your mind? Facebook asks. Compose a new tweet, Twitter beckons. Tumblr, LinkedIn, our inbox, our iPhones, the comments section on the bottom of the article you just read. Blank spaces begging to be filled in with thoughts, with photos, with stories, with what we are going to do, with what things should or could be like, what we hope will happen. Technology asking, prodding you, soliciting talk. Almost universally, the kind of performance we give on social media is positive. It's more, let me tell you how well things are going. Look how great I am. It's rarely the truth. I'm scared. I'm struggling. I don't know. At the beginning of any path, we're excited and nervous. So we seek to comfort ourselves externally instead of inwardly. There's a weak side to each of us that, like a trade union, isn't exactly malicious, but at the end of the day still wants to get as much public credit and attention as it can for doing the least. That side we call ego. The writer and former Gawker blogger Emily Gould, a real-life Hannah Horvath if there ever was one, realized this during her 2-year struggle to get a novel published. Though she had a 6-figure book deal, she was stuck. Why? She was too busy spending a lot of time on the internet. That's why. As she said, "In fact, I can't really remember anything else I did in 2010. I tumbled, I tweeted, and I scrolled. This didn't earn me any money, but it felt like work. I justified my habits to myself in various ways. I was building my brand. Blogging was a creative act. Even curating by reblogging someone else's post was a creative act, if you squinted. It was the only creative thing I was doing." In other words, she did what a lot of us do when we're scared or overwhelmed by a project. She did everything but focus on it. The actual novel she was supposed to be working on stalled completely for a year. It's easier to talk about writing, to do the exciting things related to art and creativity in literature, than to commit the act itself. She's not the only one. Someone recently published a book called Working on My Novel, filled with social media posts from writers who are clearly not working on their novels. Writing, like so many creative acts, is hard. Sitting there, staring, mad at yourself, mad at the material because it doesn't seem good enough and you don't seem good enough. In fact, many valuable endeavors we undertake are painfully difficult, whether it's coding a new startup or mastering a craft. But talking is always easy. We seem to think that silence is a sign of weakness, that being ignored is tantamount to death, and for the ego this is true. So we talk, as though our life depends on it. In actuality, silence is strength, particularly early on in any journey. As the philosopher, and as it happens a hater of newspapers and their chatter, Kierkegaard warned, "Mere gossip anticipates real talk, and to express what is still in thought weakens action by forestalling it." And that is what is so insidious about talk. Anyone can talk about him or herself. Even a child knows how to gossip or chatter. Most people are decent at hype and sales. So what is scarce and rare? Silence. The ability to deliberately keep yourself out of the conversation and subsist without its validation. Silence is the respite of the confident and the strong. Sherman had a good rule he tried to observe. He said, "Never give reasons for what you think or do until you must. Maybe, after a while, a better reason will pop into your head." The baseball and football great Bo Jackson decided he had 2 things he wanted to accomplish as an athlete at Auburn. He would win the Heisman Trophy and be taken first in the NFL draft. Do you know who he told? Nobody but his girlfriend. Strategic flexibility is not the only benefit of silence while others chatter. It is also psychology. The poet Hesiod had this in mind when he said, "A man's best treasure is a thrifty tongue." Talk depletes us. Talking and doing fight for the same resources. Research shows that while goal visualization is important, after a certain point, our mind begins to confuse it with actual progress. The same goes for verbalization. Even talking aloud to ourselves while we work through difficult problems has been shown to significantly decrease insight and breakthroughs. After spending so much time thinking, explaining, and talking about a task, we start to feel like we've gotten closer to achieving it. Or worse, when things get tough, we feel like we can toss the whole project aside because we've given it our best try, although of course we haven't. The more difficult the task, the more uncertain the outcome, the more costly talk will be, and the further we run from actual accountability. It saps us of the energy desperately needed to conquer what Stephen Pressfield calls the resistance, the hurdle that stands between us and creative expression. Success requires a full 100% of our effort, and talk flitters part of that effort away before we can use it. A lot of us succumb to this temptation, particularly when we feel overwhelmed or stressed or have a lot of work to do. In our building phase, resistance will be a constant source of discomfort. Talking, listening to ourselves talk, performing for an audience is almost like therapy. I just spent 4 hours talking about this. Doesn't that count for something? The answer is no. Doing great work is a struggle. It's draining, it's demoralizing, it's frightening. Not always, but it can feel that way when we're in the middle of it. We talk to fill the void and the uncertainty. Void, Marlon Brando, a quiet actor if there ever was one, once said, is terrifying to most people. It's almost as if we're assaulted by silence or confronted by it, particularly if we've allowed our ego to lie to us over the years, which is so damaging for one reason. The greatest work in art comes from wrestling with the void, facing it instead of scrambling to make it go away. The question is, when faced with a particular challenge, whether it is researching in a new field, starting a business, producing a film, securing a mentor, advancing an important cause, do you seek the respite of talk, or do you face the struggle head on? Think about it. A voice of a generation doesn't call itself that. In fact, when you think about it, you realize just how little these voices seem to talk. It's a song, it's a speech, it's a book. The volume of work may be light, but what's inside it is concentrated and impactful. They work quietly in the corner. They turn their inner turmoil into product, and eventually to stillness. They ignore the impulse to seek recognition before they act. They don't talk much. Or mind the feeling that others out there in public and enjoying the limelight are somehow getting the better end of the deal. They are not. They are too busy working to do anything else. And when they do talk, it's earned. The only relationship between work and chatter is that one kills the other. Let the others slap each other on the back while you're back in the lab or the gym or pounding the pavement. Plug that hole. That one right in the middle of your face that can drain you of your vital life force. Watch what happens. Watch how much better you get. To be or to do. In this formative period, the soul is unsoiled by warfare with the world. It lies like a block of pure, uncut Parian marble, ready to be fashioned into what? Orison Swett Marden. One of the most influential strategists and practitioners in modern warfare is someone most people have never heard of. His name was John Boyd. He was a truly great fighter pilot, but an even better teacher and thinker. After flying in Korea, he became the lead instructor at the elite fighter weapons school at Nellis Air Force Base. He was known as 42nd Boyd, meaning that he could defeat any opponent from any position in less than 40 seconds. A few years later, he was quietly summoned to the Pentagon, where his real work began. In one sense, the fact that the average person might not have heard of John Boyd is not unexpected. He never published any books and wrote only one academic paper. Only a few videos of him survive, and he was rarely, if ever, quoted in the media. Despite nearly 30 years of impeccable service, Boyd wasn't promoted above the rank of colonel. On the other hand, his theories transformed maneuver warfare in almost every branch of the armed forces, not just in his own lifetime, but even more so after. The F-15 and F-16 fighter jets, which reinvented modern military aircraft, were his pet projects. His primary influence was as an advisor. Through legendary briefings, he taught and instructed nearly every major military thinker in a generation. His input on war plans for Operation Desert Shield came in a series of direct meetings with the Secretary of Defense, not through public or official policy input. His primary means of effecting change was through the collection of pupils who he mentored, protected, taught, and inspired. There are no military bases named after him, no battleships. He retired assuming that he'd be forgotten, and without much more than a small apartment and a pension to his name. He almost certainly had more enemies than friends. this unusual path? What if it were deliberate? What if it made him more influential? How crazy would that be? In fact, Boyd was simply living out the exact lesson he tried to teach each promising young acolyte who came under his wing, who he sensed had the potential to be something different. The rising stars he taught probably have a lot in common with us. The speech Boyd gave to a protege in 1973 makes this clear. Sensing what he knew to be a critical inflection point in the life of the young officer, Boyd called him in for a meeting. Like many high achievers, the soldier was insecure and impressionable. He wanted to be promoted, and he wanted to do well. He was a leaf that could be blown in any direction, and Boyd knew it. So he heard a speech that day that Boyd would give again and again, until it became a tradition and a rite of passage for a generation of transformative military leaders. What he said was, "Tiger, one day you will come to a fork in the road, and you're going to have to make a decision about which direction you want to go." Using his hands to illustrate, Boyd marked off these two directions. If you go that way, you can be somebody. You will have to make compromises, and you will have to turn your back on your friends. But you will be a member of the club, and you will get promoted, and you will get good assignments. Then Boyd paused to make the alternative clear. "Or," he said, "you can go that way, and you can do something, something for your country, and for your Air Force, and for yourself. If you decide you want to do something, you may not get promoted, and you may not get the good assignments, and you certainly will not be a favorite of your superiors. But you won't have to compromise yourself. You will be true to your friends and to yourself, and your work might make a difference. To be somebody or to do something. In life, there is often a roll call. That's when you will have to make a decision." And then Boyd concluded with words that would guide that young man and many of his peers for the rest of their lives. "To be or to do," he said, "which way will you go?" Whatever we seek to do in life, reality soon intrudes on our youthful idealism. This reality comes in many names and many forms: incentives, commitments, recognition, and politics. In every case, they can quickly redirect us from doing to being, from earning to pretending. Ego aids in that deception every step of the way. It's why Boyd wanted young people to see that if we are not careful, we can very easily find ourselves corrupted by the very occupation we wish to serve. How do you prevent derailment? Well, often we fall in love with an image of what success looks like. In Boyd's world, the number of stars on your shoulder or the nature of your appointment or its location could easily be confused as a proxy for real accomplishment. For other people, it's their job title, the business school they went to, the number of assistants they have, the location of their parking space, the grants they earn, their access to the CEO, the size of their paycheck, or the number of fans that they have. Appearances are deceiving, though. Having authority is not the same as being an authority. Having the right and being right are not the same either. Being promoted doesn't necessarily mean you're doing good work, and it doesn't mean you are worthy of promotion. They call it failing upward in such bureaucracies. Impressing people is utterly different from being truly impressive. So who are you with? Which side will you choose? This is the roll call that life puts before us. Boyd had another exercise. Visiting with or speaking to groups of Air Force officers, he would write on the chalkboard in big letters the words duty, honor, and country. Then he would cross out those words and replace them with three others: pride, power, greed. His point was that many of the systems and structures in the military, the ones that soldiers navigate in order to get ahead, can corrupt the very values they set out to serve. There's a quip from the historian Will Durant that a nation is born stoic and dies Epicurean. That's the sad truth Boyd was illustrating: how positive virtues turn sour. How many times have we seen this played out in our own short lives, in sports, in relationships, or projects, or people that we care deeply about. This is what the ego does. It crosses out what matters and replaces it with what doesn't. A lot of people want to change the world, and it's good that they do.